Right. Hi, I'm David Witham, longtime Long Beach resident, here with Sander, and we're going to talk about me.
Right. Did you grow up in Long Beach?
I grew up in Long Beach, product of the Long Beach Unified School District, and went to Long Beach State for a period of time, a little bit at Long Beach City just for fun a long time ago, and yeah, definitely a product of this town.
So now, we're going to talk about a couple of different things that you're involved with. One is your professional career as a pianist up in L.A. Why don't you give me just a brief overview of that?
A brief overview. Well, it's the life of a freelance musician, which is never a dull moment kind of existence, because you can basically end up doing anything. I play recording sessions for people. I've played everything from Bach festivals to Elvis impersonators over the course of the last 35 years. And right now, I find myself in a pit orchestra at the show Wicked over at the Pantages Theater. We're in the middle of a long run right now, about a year and a half in on a two-year run.
But you've also done pretty much like the last several shows at the Pantages, right?
Well, this is the second long run I've done there. I've played on some of the shorter runs, but I did a start over there with Lion King in 2000, which was, again, a kind of a totally serendipitous occurrence. Had you told me I'd be in a Broadway pit orchestra with a couple of the biggest shows of the current time, I told you you were crazy, like say, in 1999. But now it's turned out to be, you know, 5 years of employment, you know, in the new millennium with that stuff, and it's really fun. It's a new place for me. It's just it's fun to put on a show and with actors and have the music line up with the dialogue and, you know, just kind of do that kind of thing. It's kind of an anonymous role as a musician, but still satisfying, still fun, and it kind of funds my art habit. Friend of mine calls it the secret life.
No, tell me about your art habit.
My art habit.
You have, well, Art Jones on your back.
There's plenty of that. You know, I put out a CD of my own last year called Spinning the Circle on Cryptogramophone, and have been very involved with that label since it started about 10 years ago with Jeff Gautier. We've made several CDs of his group, the Gotet, one of which is about to come out tomorrow, I think, actually. Yeah. And so we've played concerts over the years and made CDs, and we just got back from New York. We played at the Jazz Standard last month as part of the Crypto Nights at the Jazz Standard. That was a whole week's worth of crypto artists. It was pretty successful. It was well attended, and that's the music was good.
And who else is on the label?
Who else is on the label? Wow. Well, Nels Klein, Alex Klein, Scott Amendola. Benny Maupin has a beautiful new CD out on that. Guitar players like G.E. Stinson, the violinist Jenny Scheinman, Mark Dresser, great bass player. And there's a lot of artists. Jeff has done amazing work in 10 years, and he's really documented a whole scene that kind of started out here on the West Coast that's branched out and now includes people from all over the country, the Bay Area, New York. You know, it's really... it's really a joy to see him have that much success with that.
That's great. So, and then, I know that you have, this is your most recent CD, but you have others out as well, right?
Well, I have one other one. It's a self-produced effort called Online that I did about, 20 years ago now. And that's, you can buy it online at www.davidwitham.com. But that was a project I did with some of the same musicians that are on this current project, John Cross and Jay Anderson. And we did it over at Chicoria's studio and used Bernie Kirsch to engineer it and had Alex Acuna and Paul Kreibich. And I featured a few of Jay's compositions and some of mine. And I'm still happy with that record. Somebody pulled it out the other day and I heard something that was like, it kind of held up pretty good.
So. Yeah, it's a beautiful album. I have it.
Well, that's right. You digitized some stuff for me a long time ago.
Right.
So I could use real audio files, as I can recall.
Right. Yeah, it was. I love that album. It's great. And actually, I haven't heard the new one yet, but I'll need to pick up a copy for you before I leave today.
Put one in your hands before you go, along with some other stuff too.
So now, and then you have other interests as well. Outside of music, you're also an avid neon enthusiast.
I am a neon buff, and that's because of a good buddy of mine, Matt Reed Cohen. He's somebody I've known since junior high, another product of Long Beach School District and Long Beach in general. He is Neon Hunter. He's a DJ, and he had this kind of nom de plume years ago when I decided to start doing a cable access show, and he said, well, let's I have this guy, Neon Hunter, and he crawls around at night and he looks at the neon signage in Los Angeles. So we got in the car and drove about 200 miles and drove all over LA and found some really cool looking neon signs and put a kind of an up-tempo drum and bass track to it, and thus was born the Neon Hunter series. We made 11 of those little movies. You're talking about thousands of miles in the car at this point, and a lot of beautiful signs, some of which don't even exist anymore. It was kind of neat to have that archival aspect of it come to the fore. You know, at least we got them before they were gone.
Right.
So I'd say it's because of Matt that I like the neon, but he's totally attracted to it, and just hanging around him and doing all this stuff just made me an aficionado of it, and it led to an association with the Museum of Neon Art in Los Angeles. Geez, a 10-year relationship now. We've played most of their openings over the course of that time, and I've just started a new series there with Jeff Gauthier. We've kind of resurrected the Crypto Night series that we had going in Culver City over there. For First Fridays every month, we're going to have music over there.
That's great.
We just played Friday night, Jeff and I, and we did some acoustic music. He brought in we have a piano over there now, and Jeff played his acoustic violin, so we played some Gotet songs, and then we also improvised some electronic stuff. We both had a kind of an extensive electronic setup and kind of reacted to the neon signs in the building, which was really pretty fun, and we had a nice little audience, and it was a nice way to kind of kick it off. But that's going to be coming up here pretty soon.
That's great. So, and then you talk about the TV show. You sort of touched on that a little bit.
Portable Universe, yes. That's almost a 10-year thing now. Jeez, we're 104 episodes in.
And, wow.
And, yeah, who knew? It's been so much fun and such a great workshop over there. Long Beach Community Television is a wonderful place and a resource that the city really should continue to fund. I think there's some doubts about whether it will be continued to be funded next year. There's no obligation to Charter to have to fund it, but in terms of just a local resource to get local news, I think it's really more important than ever to have cable access. It's, you know, with the media consolidation and stuff, it's really hard to kind of find out what's going on the street these days, and you know, there's some nutty stuff on cable access, but there's also some really good programming and stuff that wouldn't normally see the light of day that's really important to the community.
Well, what aspect of it do you think needs to be funded?
Well, it's the operations over at the studio. I mean, because of the thing in the 70s when cable TV came in, the federal government mandated that they would have to carry a channel, or what they call PEG programming.
Right.
And that's education, government, and public access. And that was a requirement. And now that there's competition to cable, you know, fiber optics and satellite and all that stuff, it's come to the point where the federal government doesn't think it's incumbent on just cable to fund it, and it just seems like nobody's really that interested in it, so
Right. Chances
are it will not get funded, so that's
right. Kind
of a scary prospect. There's plans in the works to try to make public access a nonprofit corporation. I think Matt Kaplan is trying to organize that through Cal State Long Beach, which would be really good. But I don't know quite what the update on that is yet.
Right. Well, I mean, if, for example, though, if you didn't have access to the studios there, would you be able to produce your programming out of your home on your computer, or
I have a feeling if that's where the migration will continue, if indeed the studio goes away. The fun part of the studio is that it's a great resource in the sense that the studio is a really good sounding little room with some pretty darn good, you know, it's 1980s technology, but the cameras are good, the lenses are good. There's a decent sound system. You can put on a good little show in there. You know, it's just nice to have a studio to do that. I am fortunate enough to have some equipment that I could produce a show on my own. Some people are not as fortunate and might not have the the resources.
Right.
So that's where that, you know, it's just trying to keep a playing field for everybody. You know, I mean, of course, on the other hand, you can rent stuff really cheap now if you've really got a bug to do it. You know.
Right.
There's no excuses, really. I mean.
Right. Well, also then there's also the whole thing about VOD, video on demand.
Mm-hmm.
I know that Charter has talked sort of philosophically about having a willingness to accept public access for VOD.
And I think they are actually putting some of the programs on there at this point. I know some of the Channel 8 programs make it there, but. I think there are also a couple of from Channel 65 that, you know, some of the, they usually have the best of that show on Channel 3 once a month, and I think some of those have actually made it over to video on demand, which is, it's a step, you know, and I just hope Charter puts their money where their mouth is. They've always expressed willingness to continue to support public access, and it's, even as a gesture of goodwill, you know, I mean, I think it would be very important to do something like that.
Sure. Sure. So now, what are your shows? I mean, aside from the Neon Hunter,
what else
have you been doing?
Well, I mean, Portable Universe started out as a way to kind of showcase stuff I was involved with. You know, kind of the stuff that falls through the cracks that doesn't get a lot of local exposure or whatever.
Like what? Give me an example.
Oh, a band I play with in Laguna Beach called the Missiles of October. Really great roots rock, American music kind of band. Play with him off and on for. I think they've been together for 18 years, so I've probably been playing with them off and on for that long. That's one. I was involved with a spoken word and music group called Bluesium that had a record deal on Telarc, God, 10 years ago, but a really great guy named Adwin, a great poet. I had him on the 100th episode. You can check that out online. www.portableuniverse.tv. That's where the archives are. What else? A lot of these musicians that I kind of met from being involved with Cryptogramophone, Brad Dutz, for example, a great percussionist. He's got umpteen different groups. He had a group called the Obliteration Percussion Quartet. These guys make music on stuff you'd find in the kitchen or in the junkyard or in the backyard, you know, bunt pans and oil drums and, you know, just found objects and just making this wonderful music. And what else? Visual artists. I found a wonderful lady in San Pedro named Candace Gaughan, who makes neon art and plasma art and is a great painter, and I did a nice profile on her. And I mean, I could go on and on, but I think it's important for people to go to the site and just check it out on their own. I mean, words don't describe the beauty of some of this stuff that these people bring to the show.
So, but it was mainly arts focused.
It's arts, and, I call it entertainment, you know. I mean, we've got some kind of funny stuff, I mean, some of them maybe not so funny to some people, but you know, there's a cast of recurring characters. We have Neon Hunter, of course, who's kind of a cultural maven, and we'll go out into Long Beach and go to the Sound Walk or go to an art gallery or something and do a profile. And we've also got a guy named Frigidaire, who's really he is a bon vivant, and he's out there up in LA doing the same thing, looking for the stuff that's not in the mainstream usually.
That's great. That's great. And so how often do you pump out new episodes?
Well, sadly, not many lately. It was like from episode 90 to 100, I think it took about a year. And I mean, the studio's offered up to me once a month, and I can usually crank out two episodes in the time that they give me. So I can make two episodes a month. But with the show and just some other, I've been out of town a lot. I just haven't had a chance to go in there. So, I'm just happy that when I wasn't working, I did a lot of work.
Right.
Over there, because it seems like, as I was saying earlier, it's feast or famine with this stuff, and so you got to kind of go pile your nuts in the corner when you've got the work, and then you get to go have some fun and try to have fun when you've got time off and you're waiting for the phone to ring again.
Right. Now let's go back for a minute, if you don't mind, to the gig in L.A., the big gig, the Wicked gig.
Oh, Wicked, yeah.
Yeah, and what is it like to do... I mean, how often do you play the show?
Well, we're supposed to play it 8 times a week. I mean, that's what you got. I usually take one of those shows off just for peace of mind and to try to get 2 days off in a row. Mm-hmm. Because usually it's just Monday and then you're right back. It's, you know, 2 shows on Saturday and Sunday and Tuesday through Friday, and you've got one there, so that's 8. So it's a lot of work, and it's very challenging in the sense that not only is the show difficult musically, and it still continues to be, because it's a very kind of elastic show. It's very malleable in terms of where the music's going to move, in relation to the actors on stage. Depends on who's on stage, depends on who's in the band. You know, it's just a lot of variables. So it's a gig where it's constantly challenging that way. I mean, that can be wearying. I mean, you really have to concentrate very hard for 3 hours, and the music is just kind of relentless. It just keeps coming at you, and there's no phoning in of parts. And it's fun. It's really a lot of fun. I just had an opportunity to conduct a show the other night.
Oh yeah, tell me about that.
Well, it's still new to me, so I'm still trying to kind of get my footing with the whole thing. I mean, the first one, they've both gone fairly well, I think. I mean, they asked me back, so we didn't have to stop. But it's a charge. I mean, it's really something. It's truly stimulating, because you're kind of the focal point in a way. I mean, everybody's looking for you for the cues, the band, the actors, the backstage people. You know, it's just...
So, as a conductor, are you leading the actors on the stage, or are you following them to accompany them with...
A little from column A and a little from column B, you know what I mean? There are spots where you're supposed to lead, there are spots where you're supposed to be call a voce, as they would say in Italian. You're supposed to follow the voice. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you have to make a big cue that you wouldn't normally do just for the backstage so they can cue a sound effect or something like that. So you've really got to be deliberate about certain things. And there's a lot of what they call safety vamps in the show, so you've got to indicate when you're going to go out of those and move on down the road, so to speak, musically. And as I said, all these things they're all in play, you know, as when you're standing up there. And it's fun. It's really, when it's all working right, it's a lot of fun. It's something new for me, that's for sure. I always tried to get out of orchestra when I was in school.
So now, when you're just playing, when you're not conducting, when you're playing, you're focused on the conductor. You're not really looking at the actors.
No, we can't. And I mean, there are a few that can, but we can't. We're in a pit, so we can't see the actors for the most part. And sadly, this is kind of it's a function of what we're doing. We have to basically look at a monitor. We can't even see the conductor. I'm behind the conductor under the front row. So I can see his feet if I look up, the back of his feet. But I have to look at him in the camera, and it's hard, I know, as a conductor now, because, you know, when you're conducting an orchestra, you're usually facing the musicians, and you can be specific in terms of, like, okay, you play quiet or you play louder. And conductor now is just looking down the barrel of a camera, and it's like, if you go like this, the whole orchestra, if you move your hand down to make them softer, the whole orchestra gets softer, instead of, like, I'm looking at the flute player, you know?
Right, right.
So it's really difficult that way, you know, I mean, both for the musicians and for the conductor. It's just kind of a strain. But the fact that we do it so many times, you know, we get our timing together, and, you know, there's a simpatico there, and it just works out over time. But yeah, we're watching the conductor. That's all we can do. That's all we got to go on, really. I mean, right. Except for stuff you can hear, vocal cues you can hear.
So now, you've been doing this for, it's going on a long time now. How long has it been?
Well, this show has been a year and a half.
Year and a half. And it's probably going to go for another half year at least.
Yeah, that's what we got. We're closing January 11th.
So in that time, I mean, obviously there's probably a period where... in the course of rehearsing, in the course of bringing the show up to speed, and you're kind of getting familiar with the parts and all that kind of stuff. I mean, that happened a year ago. You know?
Yeah, it happened a long time
ago. Yeah, and but now, I mean, is there still kind of anything that you're discovering that's new?
Yeah, and again, the challenge is the repetition and trying to keep it fresh and play it with energy. You know, play it with like a kind of a first timey kind of energy. And I feel lucky in the sense that I kind of enjoy that. I enjoy the repetition. It gives you a chance to get it right, so to speak. You know, but as you go along and you master your part, then you start listening even more. I mean, you're always listening to what's going on around you, but then you can kind of, as you're playing, you can kind of listen to the orchestration a little more and like, oh, really follow the oboe part through as you're playing, or, you know, you've got to find things like that to keep it interesting in your mind, you know. And for me, I knew at some point I was probably going to conduct it, so I was always kind of listening from that mindset, trying to keep the radar up in terms of just what it felt like and what the pacing was generally, at least, you know, and try to get all that stuff, you know, at least kind of physically in your body, you know, somehow.
To keep it nuanced. And
yeah, well, you know, and then there's so many levels. I mean, you master the piano part, but then it's like, okay, we'll go conduct the orchestra, and then that's, you know, how many more layers, you know? It's just, it's really something. And it's, like I said, it's definitely new ground for me. As you told me I'd been doing this 10 years ago, I'd say you're out of your mind.
Now, what about the camaraderie of the group? I mean, I know that there's the band, and then there's the actors on stage, and there's probably the production people behind mm-hmm. the scenes. Are they pretty much?
Everybody gets along great. It's quite a family over there. I mean, this one, we didn't get to know the actors as well. It's taken us a little longer because we just kind of went in and did about 3 rehearsals and started doing shows. It was really quick because Wicked had been here before, apparently, and a lot of the people had played it, so they knew that they could just kind of come in and kind of bang it together and it would, you know, come out okay. Lion King was a different case. I mean, there were 6 weeks of pre-production, and it was a process, you know. It was like they just, you know, kept adding elements, you know, the dance. I was doing a lot of dance rehearsals, and you said, oh, okay, well, this is cool. And then they start adding the puppetry, and you're like, wow, what's this? Then you do the first, like, kind of dress rehearsal, and you start to see, geez, what the spectacle of this whole thing is. And it's like, yeah, that's really fun. That's a great process, you know. And through that, of course, you get to know everybody, and that's where you make your friends. And this orchestra has been fairly consistent since Lion King, and so there are a lot of old friends there. You know, you might have had a break of a few years before you've seen them, and it's a really nice group of people. When you do a run that long, you can't have any loose cannons. You just got to have people that get along with one another, and that is truly the case over there at the theater.
That's awesome. Now, do you know what the next show is that's coming in?
Well, there's not going to be much for us coming up because they're going back to their subscription series, and generally those runs are tours that are fairly well self-contained. There's some minimums that have to be met per the union contract with the house and in the case of musicians. But that's and going to end up being a handful of players, probably horn and string players, because they'll bring their own rhythm sections. So I'll be back out on the street trying to figure out what's next.
So, well, what about, let's talk about your album. Give me the title again.
Spinning the Circle.
Spinning the Circle. What does that mean?
I don't know. It kind of is like, it's kind of like the radio dial. When you had an AM radio when you were a kid, and you could like spin that dial and you could kind of end up somewhere and you'd hear this cool music. And I mean, AM radio was a little more interesting back then, and just in terms of what guys could program and stuff. So maybe it's that. I thought I was going to be spinning in circles because I felt like I was driving in circles going back to the theater and here to Long Beach every day. So that felt like a real circle. But it's just, we were just playing with words. It's more about the alliteration of it than anything specific. Mm-hmm. And it's a record that's got a lot of different kinds of stuff on it. It's kind of a lot of stuff filtered through my brain. There's free improvisation. There's jazzy stuff. There's electronics. There's pretty ballads. There's kind of atonal madness to some people. Just it's just a little bit of everything. It's just kind of what I'm about, you know. It's just, it took a long time to get to it, but
any standards?
No, it's not a jazz record. It's all original music.
That's great.
If I play standards, it's usually with somebody else at this point. I don't have anything against the Great American Songbook, but mm-hmm. I think at this point I've got to, as a jazz musician, I just feel like things need to be pushed forward
right.
still. You know, we've kind of, there's been kind of a regression for a while. Things got a little comfortable, I think, and it just feels like, you know, we've got to hear some new writing and just kind of get on to the next phase or whatever it is.
Right. Right, no, I totally agree. It's, I think that's one of the exciting things about music is that there's always an opportunity for discovering new things. You know, never, and even like when you're talking about the repetition of the performance, you know, that's one of the really exciting things, that there's always in each moment that opportunity for opening up something.
Absolutely,
new.
Absolutely. I learned that a long time ago from George Benson. Because I worked with George for, God, 18 years, just till recently. And here's a guy, I mean, we would play This Masquerade and on Broadway every night, and Lord knows he'd played it hundreds, if not thousands of times before I joined the band. And I watched this guy go out there, and he would play, it would even be the solo off the record, and he would play with this kind of, with this joy, with this enthusiasm that was just, you know, it was just palpable. I call it the championship energy. You know, it's like the Michael Jordan kind of energy, or the Kobe kind of energy, or whatever for the modern day, where you just, you know, you project that, and you do find that joy. You do find the, you know, it just feels like you're having fun and you're discovering, and you know, you want people to feel that way when you go to a show. You know, it's. You don't want to get too, you know, you want to be deep, but you don't want to get too deep, you know. I mean, in George's case, he's more about people having a good time. He's not trying to, you know, not trying to change the world or anything. He's just out to have a concert, have a good time, you know.
Right, right. Yeah. Now, what was that? What was your role in that?
Well, I was a pianist and musical director for George. So, you know, basically running the band, counting off the tunes and cutting them off and. Rehearsing when needed, and if we did a symphony show, you know, getting together with the string players and getting all that together, and you know, charts, and you know, just kind of the busy work kind of stuff. But that's a big chair in George's band. I mean, back in the Breezin days, he had a fellow named Jorge Dalto, who was the piano player in the band, and he was he's no longer with us, unfortunately. He died way too young, but he was just fabulous player from Argentina, who just, talk about somebody who had the passion. I mean, this guy was, and basically legendary in that chair. So for me to come in, you know, how many years later, and try to fill those shoes, it was a big challenge and a charge, you know, when George looks back and gives you the big smile when the solo went good or whatever.
And what kind of touring schedule were you on with that?
It varied. It started out, it was about 6 months a year, and it kind of diminished over the course of time to where it's, George probably works 3 or 4 months out of the year at this point, you know, kind of mostly in the summer. Doesn't really like to travel in the winter time, so it's, you know, kind of spring into summer into fall is when he likes to work at this point. And plus he's getting up in years. I'm sure he doesn't want to hit it as hard as he once did. I mean, geez, guy's been around the world I don't know how many times.
So now, but are you not doing that anymore?
No, I got the show and I wanted to stay home, and I was trying to do some of the shorter runs with them, and they really just kind of felt like they wanted somebody full time. Mm-hmm. So they went back to a guy who had been doing it before me, and we've kind of traded the gig back and forth over the course of time. When I couldn't do it, he'd fill in for me, and vice versa. So it's worked out. I mean, George is definitely covered on the piano front with David Garfield, who's the other gentleman.
So now, the new album, Spinning the Circle.
Spinning the Circle, yeah.
Did you have a real specific idea about the kinds of things that you wanted to bring to it? I know that you talked about a lot of different variety, That you have a lot of different ideas represented. Did you sit down and write material for the album, or were these things that you had been accumulating in the 20 years prior to the...
Yeah, since online. Yeah, well, it's kind of more along those lines. And Jeff had offered me this record, I mean, when Lion King was going on, so I mean, like in 2001 or 2 or something, and he said, you know, you want to do a record? And I was like, yeah, yeah. And then the next thing I knew, it was 2006. And I thought, well, got to do this. And then it took a year to get all the musicians together in one place at the same time. So I knew I wanted to do some of the songs. I knew I wanted to try to write with some of the musicians involved, with Jay Anderson, the bassist, and he ended up contributing a song to the record. And I had a couple of like fragmented ideas that ended up coalescing into the Afrobeat song that's kind of at the end of the record. And there were a couple more that were just kind of in the hopper from a while back, and I played another song from a great musician that I know up in L.A. named Mike Miller, who's a great guitar player, and I played a piano trio version of one of his songs. And so I would say I finished some stuff for this record. Mm-hmm. You know, there were some ideas kind of floating around, and it was like, okay, you know, I think I had to draw a line in the sand or something. But the process was interesting, because I think when Jeff offered it to me, I just didn't know who I was artistically at that point. And I spent a number of years, and Portable Universe was part of that process. I spent a number of years just like observing artists, musicians, different creative types, and just kind of watching them at the process and seeing what happened, and getting advice from these people like Nels Klein and Norton Wisdom, and just trying to learn by their example about how to just comport yourself as an artist, you know, because I've always been a sideman guy. I've always worked for a lot of people and try to do the right thing for the situation kind of thing. But then when it's like a wide open blank canvas, it's kind of frightening. You know, you got to figure out, well, what the hell is it who are you, you know? So I thought, well, the record is a lot of stuff, and I'm interested in a lot of stuff. So it just had to kind of end up being me as the filter for a lot of different rhythmic and melodic and harmonic influences from around the world, you know?
That's great.
And I guess it was, you know, and then once it happened, I mean, we recorded the record in 2 days, and it came out great. And, I mean, there was a little bit of a gamble there, because it was a bunch of musicians who'd never played together before. I'd played with all of them in different situations, but who knew whether it was going to work that day, you know, or whether that combo was really going to be the one. But that was all great, and it was finished and edited and mixed it really quick, and the graphics came together really quick. So it was just like, I guess it was the right time for it all to occur, you know.
Right. Wow, that's really exciting. I mean, I think that's fantastic. It's, you know, I think that you know probably really well that, you know, when you bring certain people together, you know, because you've played with them all, you know what their capabilities are, you know what their leanings are, their, mm-hmm. you know, and so when you bring those people together, even though all these combinations are sort of mysterious, when you put it all together and press record, I think you probably know in your heart anyway that something good is going to happen, even if it's not exactly what you expect.
Well, and hopefully it isn't exactly what you expect, because, you know, for example, I did a session with Larry Carlton and Lee Ritenour that they had the great pianist Claire Fisher on, and Larry Carlton was like, he hadn't written out any introduction for a song, and he was like, oh, Claire, I just want you to do what you do, you know, I want you to do that Claire Fisher thing. And Claire just looked at him and said, well, that's your interpretation of me. You know, that's, you know. So it was like, and then he told the story of like working in the studios in the 60s, and he'd be doing the sessions, and the producer would say, well, can you play a little bit like more like Joe Sample? And this went on for a period of years, and, you know, occasionally it would happen. And then he finally ran into Joe Sample and told him this story, and Joe was laughing, and he said, man, every time I go into the studio, they say, can you play it a little more like Claire Fisher? So, you know, you in your heart, you, you hope it's going to work. I mean, you can't predict. I mean, you just don't know. You have an inkling. And hopefully it'll be something that you didn't expect, and the sum of the parts are going to be greater than the, you know, that, you know.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, too, is that after the recordings are all done and you the CD is pressed and you get it home and you sit it down and you listen to it, you play it through, were there things that surprised you after the fact? That
Well, by that time, I'd say no, because you've done your crafting and your polishing, and it's like you know this thing too well, mm-hmm. almost in a way. And at that point, for me, it's like you got to kind of put it away for a while,
right,
and then come back to it. But I don't know. I've still. It's been a year. I don't pull it out and listen to it. I pull out other people's records and listen to it. But it's still sounding good. You know. I mean. I think it will continue to. I think it's going to be like that other one. It's just. It doesn't. I try to not to make them sound like a time period. You know. Right. Like there was a period in the 80s where you know you could tell records came from there because of the instruments that were, synthesizers that were used.
Right.
Things like that. You know. I'm just trying to. Try to use acoustic instruments and make it a little broader than that, not quite so specific time-wise.
Great. So now, after this show is over, do you have any specific plans?
I'm scared. I don't know. I want to try to stay off the road. I've kind of built up a little video business here, profiling artists and doing band shoots and stuff, and I'd really like to kind of do more of that. I really, that's something I really enjoy. I've always enjoyed photography, and it's a really fun way to kind of link photography and music, and I feel like I could do good stuff for people because of my musical background, and there's just things that translate across, like for feeling of the rhythm of things and the pacing of things when you're making a video of somebody. It kind of feels like you're making music in a way. It's fun.
Yeah, I've definitely noticed that before. I've worked on some video productions as well, and I know that I've worked with guys that weren't musicians and worked with guys that were, and you can totally tell.
It's usually the choices they make in terms of where the cuts are and where the edit points are, or what the edit is. Yeah, it is really true. I mean, and some of the great editors are musicians. A guy like Walter Murch.
You know, I'm a huge fan of his.
He's awesome. I mean, I just bought that book of his called In the Blink of an Eye, and he's just, you know, he's talking about the notion of how one frame more or one frame less can really just like destroy the whole notion of a cut or the emotion you're trying to convey and all that stuff. And he works standing up so he can kind of sway to the rhythm of the piece he's working on. It's really cool. He's something else.
Yeah. Well, also camera work, too. I've noticed that guys that are musicians who are doing camera work, they have a different sense of where to be and what to look at,
mm-hmm.
especially when you're doing music shoots.
Well, if you're doing a band shoot, I think having somebody who knows something about music is just so important. I mean, when we do stuff over the studio, my buddy Matt, who's a great keyboard player, too, I try to get him out there on the camera because at least he knows when there's a bass solo that you go to the bass, or you know, it's they're not like looking at the drummer or something, you know. And we take that stuff for granted, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, we know which instrument is making the sound, but I mean, for somebody who's not a musician, that's not always the case, you know. You can't blame them for it. You just have to have a good director who can kind of get people on, you know, get them on point quick enough to have it all make sense, you know.
Right. Well, so what kind of productions have you done in the past?
Well, let's see. I profiled that artist that I was telling you about, Candace Gaughan. Mm-hmm. I did it for her. She did a mid-career retrospective, so I kind of just had met her right when that was going on, so I documented her opening. I did a piece on an artist named Ralph Glenmore, a great visual artist, who was the dance supervisor on Lion King.
Oh, wow.
It turned out he's a really, really, really good artist. I just did something for a company, and their client was a school in LA. They were having an award show, but it's a dance school in LA, downtown LA, and they provide dance instruction and stuff for inner city kids that can't afford it. And I had to just prepare the bumpers for their award show, the 2-minute bumpers for each of their awardees. Mm-hmm. And one of them was a woman who in the original New York City Ballet, I can't think of her name off the top of my head, you know, hung around with Picasso and Stravinsky and Matisse and all these people, and one of the guys was Arthur Duncan, who was the tap dancer on the Lawrence Welk show, and he was also in the movie Tap with Greg Hines and Sammy Davis Jr. And the school looked really neat. I mean, it just looked like they were providing a really great service for these kids, and they've also become a charter school with a really rigorous academic program, and I guess they're award winning and stuff. So it was, you know, I learned some stuff about dance and made a few bucks, and
that's great.
And just kept it in the arts, you know. I mean, that's the whole thing. I mean, I just want to, I want to try to provide some support for artists, you know, of all kinds. You know?
Right. That's great. That's great. And so, you were talking about your monthly.
First Friday is at the Museum of Neon Art, which is on 136 4th Street in downtown LA. It's between Spring and Grand. And First Friday, we're going to go from 8 to 10, and it'll be probably me, usually. Maybe Jeff Gautier and usually a mystery guest, or we'll kind of start getting the bookings together, but we're just getting on our feet here. Unfortunately, in July, the first Friday is the 4th of July weekend, so we're not going to do anything. But there's an opening on July 12th, Saturday night, from 7 to 10, that'll feature the Neon Hunter Collective, which is myself and my buddy Matt Neon Hunter Cohn. Mm-hmm. And I think we are going to have a mystery guest there. It'll either be Jeff Gautier or TBD, to be determined.
Uh-huh.
It'll be somebody from previous Kryptonite stuff. That was the late lamented series in Culver City we had for about 3 years, and in a really cool little Salvadoran restaurant.
Oh, wow. That's great. Well, awesome. Was there anything else that we need to touch on?
I don't think so. DavidWitham.com, PortableUniverse.tv.
Great.
Check them out. There's plenty of archives up there.